When dealing with backslidden people in his day, did Jesus support or modify the strong-arm methods of Ezra and Nehemiah? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series on Ezra and Nehemiah. And our theme for this week is backslidden people. My conversation partners are Brant Berglund, Dave Thomas, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. So, let's compare Jesus' methods with the methods of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now we're talking.
So what do you regard as the strong arm methods of Ezra and Nehemiah, Alden?
Beat someone, curse someone, pulled out their hair.
Plucked out their beards.
Yeah. Yeah.
And threatened them with stoning or whatever if they bring in sticks on the Sabbath, right?
Well, and this is the last chapter, and we're going to deal with that this lesson and the next one. It is fascinating. Nehemiah tells them when the merchants came in on the Sabbath, if you do that again, I will lay hands on you. And it's very interesting. Said they did not come again.
Maybe he was also a big fellow.
People looked at him.
You know, it's funny to use the phrase the laying on of hands. That's a gracious thing, but having hands laid upon you is not good.
That's right. Yeah. Good. So let's be blunt.
Alden, I think it's circumstantial. I think in days of great turmoil and upset and distress, that heavy-handed methods may be far more necessary than times when there's stability and gentleness can prevail.
Paul spoke to the Galatians very differently than he spoke to the Philippians. And it seems to me that the situation may warrant stronger words, but I think, Alden, you're asking more than just words. There's some physical aspect here, isn't there?
You like to quote Paul's comment, shall I come to you how?
With a stick or with
love and
the spirit of gentleness.
Yeah, yeah. See, so what makes the difference?
But you see, the interesting thing about those are all after the Gospels. When you look at the story of Jesus, it is remarkably gentle. Now, he has some strong words against...
But now you're just undermining your case.
No.
He has strong words for the for hypocrites and charlatans and religious leaders who are misbehaving. He's not very gentle.
But those are words.
Oh, I see. They're not actions.
Yeah. And I've wondered how far you can get with rhetoric instead of, you know, cursing some and beating some. And I mean that seriously. I think you can make some progress with rhetoric.
But some of what Nehemiah did was just to act assertively so that people didn't dare try something. And see, that's another thing that fascinated me, because when I was a young man, I was quite afraid of conflict. I would go out of my way to avoid it until I got run over too many times. And then I learned to be a lot more assertive. And I read a book once on assertiveness, that assertiveness is a very valuable tool. It doesn't do harm to anybody, but just lets them know that you're not going to be bulldozed, see, without some reaction. And then they don't want to find out what the reaction is, so they don't harm you.
Well, you know, Jesus didn't shy away from the conflict, but it is interesting that the quotation from the Old Testament that is found here in Matthew 12, a battered reed he will not break off, and a smoldering wick he will not put out until he leads justice to mercy, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. There is a sense that Jesus, if he saw somebody who was weak and hurting, he didn't push them away. And yet the same Jesus said, look, anybody who puts their hand on the plow and then turns back, you're not worthy of following me. So he had kind of two different approaches, I think, for different needs and people.
That's true. But Jesus never killed anyone. And one of my favorite lines is, when Jesus cleansed the temple, he attacked the furniture, not the people.
Well, maybe that's what Nehemiah did.
But let's just tick off now. We're dealing with Nehemiah 13. Now, Nehemiah 13 has five different issues, and our study guide takes the strongest one, most difficult one, mixed marriages, and that's one lesson by itself, and that's the one which we deal with next. But this is what happened. Nehemiah was gone for 12 years, and when he came back, significant backsliding had taken place, and I'll just list them off here. First of all, they had allowed Ammonites and Moabites to be part of the assembly. The people had read in the law, that is not to be done. So
no Ruths allowed.
Yep. Then they had allowed Tobiah, an Ammonite, according to Nehemiah 2, an enemy of the people, to set up housekeeping on the temple precincts. Mm. They'd taken one of the pastor's studies, for example. We don't have enough pastors, but we can let Tobiah in here. See? And then the Levites were left unsupported. They didn't provide the tithes and offerings for the Levites. Sabbath practices had been left unprotected. And this is where you get the strong hand, again, of Nehemiah. And then there were mixed marriages. Now, let's consider each of these terms, each of these in terms of seriousness, okay? And let's assess the handling of these issues against the teaching of Jesus. Now, let's take the first one, excluding Moabites and Ammonites. What would Jesus say about that?
Jesus would not have overtly said they have to be part of Israel. He simply would have gone to them where they were.
Well, in fact, you have this amazing story, the Canaanite woman.
The Canaanite woman, right.
And the Samaritan woman.
Yep. He goes, and I love how John phrases it, and Jesus had to go to the region of Samaria. Yeah, any Jew would know you don't ever have to go there. But Jesus went out of his way to go there.
Yeah.
So
you have now, in the Old Testament, you have Ruth was a Moabite, and she's in Jesus' genealogy.
Right.
And also became part of the royal Davidic bloodline, of course. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another one. This is surprising because they talk about the Moabites and the Ammonites. The only wife of Solomon's 700 wives and 300 concubines that we know by name is Naamah, the Ammonite.
The Ammonite.
The mother of Rehoboam.
Yeah.
So in the royal genealogies, you have Moabites and Ammonites.
Ammonites both. Yeah.
And what do you do?
I think it all has to do with how much they affect the ethos that Nehemiah is trying to create or that Jesus is trying to create. And it seems to me that those two circumstances are very, very different. In Jesus' day, the Moabites, the few Moabites and Ammonites who came around were not a danger. But I think in the days of Nehemiah, they were.
And when you hear Ruth say to Naomi, "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God," she's adopting
that culture
as her own, and that's maybe more that's significant.
So I don't think this was very serious in Jesus' day, but I think it was quite serious in Nehemiah's
day. Circumstances are certainly different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now the next one, let's evaluate this one for seriousness. What about Tobiah the Ammonite giving room in the temple?
When you look at Tobiah and Sanballat and the others as characters, they simply oppose the work. And it's shocking to me that anybody would have allowed them. But maybe over time, his position softened and they said, look, he's not a problem anymore. Let's bring him in. Maybe he'll have a change of heart.
Yeah. Now, question. Nehemiah cleansed the temple. Jesus cleansed the temple. My suspicion is that on practical terms, I think Jesus would support the exclusion of Tobiah.
Of Tobiah.
Yep.
You don't belong here.
Yeah, because he's destroying the ethos.
Yep.
And intentionally doing it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Weaseling his way in.
The other aspect here, which is intriguing, is that they weren't paying the Levites. Do you think Jesus would support the strong arm action to restart paying the Levites?
Now, remind me what he did. He just told people they had to start coughing up the money?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, the danger I see here is that if the Levites weren't being supported, then they would have to support themselves, which would have taken them away from the religious function.
Yeah, nobody to run the temple services.
So I can see how you'd crank them up and say, hey, get on with it.
Yep. So my suspicion is, and I think you two would agree with this, that Jesus would support that business of making sure that the Levites. Mm-hmm. Now, the next one is intriguing, the Sabbath breaking. Now, John Brunt has a delightful little book entitled Day for Healing, in which he talks about the five major miracles of Jesus that happened on the Sabbath. Could have happened any other day, but he seems to have been
very... They were all chronic cases, not acute cases. Yep.
Yep. Now, but Jesus never did his shopping on the Sabbath. So the kinds of things that they were ruling out back in Nehemiah's day, I think they would be radically different than the kinds of trouble that Jesus got into.
So, but I wonder for our day, and maybe you guys can help me with this. I have friends who don't mind going out to eat on the Sabbath, and they'll attend a restaurant after church because that way they don't have to work, because cooking is too much work and they don't have time on Friday preparation to do it. Where do you put that? Or am I meddling now? Am I getting too close to home?
I think that's a very good question. Are we going to make, in fact, some wag has said, the Sabbath command doesn't apply to the women.
It's just the men.
Yeah. But remember, the commandment says neither your servant, nor manservant, nor manservant, or the strangers within your gates. And I would say that somebody who is working
for you correct,
is comes under that. You should not be putting them in a position where they have to work.
And that would be my argument as well. It's like anybody whom I have control over, I should be helping to enter into God's rest that day.
Yeah.
And if I'm making someone work for me, even if I'm paying
them
to
do it. But people say, well, they're working anyway, and by going to their restaurant, you actually help them earn a living.
Yeah.
The very devout people are inclined to make very rigorous, and if you really try to follow the letter of the law, it becomes incredibly difficult to survive.
Mm.
The only way to do that is to move far into the wilderness and simply get away from the world.
See? Well, some people don't eat on Sabbath very much. They just don't. They have a very simple meal and then maybe fast for the rest of the day, and that's it.
But maybe that's a nitpicky thing. What seems to be going on here in the days of Nehemiah is much more significant.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's opening the shop, setting up for practice, and so much for worship and the day of rest.
On balance, as you look at all of these, there's
what about the mixed marriages?
We're going to deal with that next week.
Oh, okay.
And that's the toughest one.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But as you look at all these balances, there have been significant changes. Ezra and Nehemiah lived in a very difficult time, as I mentioned once in an earlier lesson, that what was happening down in Elephantine Island in Egypt shows what a great threat was there.
Mm-hmm. You mean that Yahweh had gotten
a... Yahweh had a wife, and those kinds of things just really made it very problem. Now, Dave, you had a piece that you wanted to raise before.
Yeah, what about the numbers in some of those genealogies? We talked about the genealogies a while ago, but what can we say a bit about that? Because some of the numbers seem to be way out of...
Too big, too large?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's, I have a chapter of this in my book, Inspiration, if you want to know the details, and there's also in the study guide that's available here. There are a couple of things involved. For one thing, the word thousand, this is an intriguing one. It can mean thousand, but it can also mean fighting unit, and it can also mean a chieftain.
Or a clan.
Or a clan. Based around them.
Yeah, see. And so if you could have 10 chieftains, or you could have 10 clans, or you have 10,000.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
So that, and it's based on just the Hebrew word.
See? Yeah, and so that's remains indistinct, and it's those numbers.
It's not that clear. Yeah. So my point is that you should not simply judge things, numbers in the Bible. You have to be very careful.
Very careful.
So on that cheerful note, we are out of time. Thank you very much. And thank you to our program engineer, Brad Williams, and for all of you for listening in. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.